Don't frighten us by telling us the facts. 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 We must be the great arsenal of democracy. For us, this is an emergency as serious as war itself. We must apply ourselves to our task.
For 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark in the great state of Delaware, I'm Bill Humphrey and thanks for listening. The following episode was recorded on July 1st, 2018 for release on July 3rd and produced by me at my studio in Newton, Massachusetts. This week, Nate and Rachel join me to discuss the Supreme Court rulings on Muslim immigrants, public employee unions, and bakeries. Then we talk about the protests against family separation, the Abolish ICE movement, and the election of Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez. Episodes are available for download on Tuesdays at arsenalfordemocracy.com and from iTunes or Stitcher. We air the show in Delaware on 91.3 FM and stream it simultaneously from WVUD.org on Tuesdays at noon Eastern. Follow us on Twitter at AFD Radio or like us on Facebook. This is Arsenal for Democracy. You're listening to Arsenal for Democracy. I'm your host, Bill Humphrey. Joining me again in studio this week is Nate. Hello, Nate.
Hey, Bill.
And joining us on the line, as usual, from Idaho is Rachel. Hi, Rachel.
Hi, Bill. Hi, Nate.
So we're going to go through a whole range of items in this half hour. Rather than doing our usual deep dives, I know we try to stay away from doing news of the week stuff, but we felt like that Nate and I were talking about this the other night. There were so many things that happened that normally would have been like month-long stories or whatever that just happened in the last week or maybe a little bit into the week before that we thought it would be good to talk about it. First things first, let's talk about the Supreme Court. Obviously, like the really big thing that everyone's paying attention to is Justice Kennedy announcing that he's retiring, et cetera, et cetera. That's kind of like a huge problem, but I think everyone else has pretty much covered that one, so I don't know how much more depth there is necessarily to go into it. You guys can bring up stuff if you want. But I think that that sort of obscured the fact that there were two pretty significant Supreme Court decisions this past week that were pretty terrible. And then there was one a little bit earlier, maybe a couple weeks before that, that we also should talk about. First, I want to mention the Muslim ban, basically, whatever they're calling it, was upheld. You know, the ban that's on countries of Muslim majorities, but not a Muslim ban. You know, like they, for some reason, they decided to uphold that because a bunch of racist fascists. And I think because of this all happening around the same time as the child concentration camps stuff is happening with the border and the Latin American immigrants, it did not get as much attention as it would have if it had happened more in isolation like it did at the beginning of the Trump administration when this was initially proposed. So I didn't see like airport protests happening or whatever. I'm not sure if this took immediate effect. They upheld that. I don't know. Do you guys have any comments on that particular story? I saw some at the protests related to the other immigration stuff. I did see some folks with signs related to the Muslim ban, but again, it seemed like it wasn't really that much. Rachel, any thoughts?
So I wanted to highlight SCOTUS blog, which has a lot of really in-depth discussions on Supreme Court rulings. They had a symposium, Trump v. Hawaii, Cory Matsuo's Ghost, and National Security Masquerades. So basically, the author Harold Hongju Ko argued that the Muslim ban shows a deep racial animus on the part of the president. And the fact that SCOTUS didn't knock it down on the merit was a really, really poor decision. Donald Trump in his Twitter has said, Islam hates us and we can't allow people coming into this country who have this hatred of the United States. So obviously it's a call to discriminate against people based on their religious background, which is, I can't see the merit of this case, of Trump's case. And it's appalling that the Supreme Court ruled this way. the fact that the majority didn't really take his Twitter into account as part of his remarks and part of the argument for the ban is seems very disingenuous. And I believe the minority, the dissension, pointed that out.
So Korematsu, for those who aren't familiar off the top of their heads, that's the decision relating to Japanese internment, I believe basically upholding Japanese internment as constitutionally valid during World War II. And again, we're talking in that case about Japanese Americans, actually, not Japanese immigrants. So then, of course, they're trying to say, so the dissent here in this case is saying this is absurd, this is on the similar level of Korematsu, which was a huge disaster and we all regret. The majority opinion is specifically saying, no, this is not Korematsu, this is not based on Korematsu, blah, 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 this is totally valid. And their rationale here was basically similar, I think, to what they said in Korematsu, which was they, you know, made a national security executive power, you know, is unlimited type decision for wartime. Now they're saying, well, the president can do whatever the president wants with regard to immigration. That's totally within his purview. And the only way that it's an invalid constitutional executive order is if the president says it's an invalid constitutional executive order and issues a new one, which is nonsense.
Right. Well, and Trump explicitly compared his plans involving Muslims to FDR. What I'm doing is no different from FDR. Trump told Good Morning America via telephone. And this was when he was being attacked by critics for his, you know, total shutdown. I mean, take a look at what FDR did many years ago. And he's one of the most highly respected presidents. I mean, respected by most people. They name highways after him. And then going on, and it's like, oh, this is not, I don't want to bring it back, George, not at all. I don't like doing it at all. It's a temporary measure until our representatives, many of whom are grossly incompetent, our representatives can figure out what's going on. And of course, there's no time limit on any of this. They're never going to figure out what's going on. But I mean, yeah, as you said, Bill, like when it comes to wartime, we're now in a situation of permanent war, endless war. And so when the president does it, that means it's not illegal, as of course Nixon famously put it. And I mean, that kind of is true in a lot of senses. They can pretty much do whatever they want when it comes to national security. And if they want to just throw up dissidents, put them in camps or whatever, that, I mean, that can happen. There was pretty serious restrictions on civil rights. For example, during World War I, various sedition acts, things like that. So that's not out of the realm of possibility. And the Supreme Court's not really going to stop it. So they've made that pretty clear.
I think the other thing that's like been bothering me for a long time with the Korematsu stuff and in relation to this specific proposal is that this came up in 2015 in the early phases of the Trump campaign and various other just Republicans going off the deep end. I don't remember off the top of my head if that was related or not or whatever, but there was some discussion about the fact that there were some people basically saying that we should have these like Muslim American internment camps or something along those lines. Even I think there was at one point Wesley Clark, Democratic presidential candidate from 2004, was going around for some reason like saying this was a good idea. Anyway, but I remember that this came up about this idea of camps and that sort of thing. And, you know, it ends up being that, you know, what ends up happening is, oh, we built the camps for the Latin American immigrants and we just did the ban for the Muslim American for the Muslim immigrants and legal permanent residents and so forth. But I remember like in November of 2015, you know, citing there was basically a resolution that was eventually passed decades later saying that like the internment was bad and we need to like make reparations for it, etc. And the key line there was to inform the public about the internment of such individuals so as to prevent the recurrence of any similar event. And instead, they end up just like citing it. And, you know, well, in this case, they're saying, no, we're not doing that. But it's like, but you had people, Republicans, senior Republicans in Congress in 2015 trying to say like, well, we did this before with the Japanese Americans, so you can't stop us from doing it again. And it's like, well, you weren't supposed to do it again. That was, I mean, you shouldn't have done it in the first place either. Let's talk a little bit about the Janus case now. Keep it moving here. So that was the case regarding AFSCME and sort of public employee unions in general, saying that you don't have to, like, it's a free speech violations or something like that. I mean, that's the argument they're making in this decision to compel members to pay for their membership in a public employee union and to pay dues if they're not a member, to pay dues to the union that is negotiating on their behalf anyway, because these things are negotiated as huge collective bargaining contracts that cover a lot of people. and it's a big problem if you have free riders who are getting, you know, the benefits of the negotiating without actually contributing to it. A pretty bad decision for a lot of public employee unions that are probably going to start, you know, losing some members and some dues that they did need. That's bad. But I will say that, like, one of the big themes that I think we've tried to emphasize over the past several months on this show is that there was a labor movement that was very strong in this country before the era where everything was legalized and you could have, you know, mandatory dues collection and stuff like that. We've also seen these huge protests with, like, teachers unions and other public employee unions all across the country this year, you know, protesting for better wages and other collective bargaining things and so forth. But in many cases, those were organized by the members, not by the union leadership themselves. So although this is a bad decision for public employee unions, unions in this country have been in a pretty bad downward spiral for several decades, and I think that they need to really shake things up, and this may be the thing that actually gets them to shake things up. I think some of the unions are going to be destroyed because they don't do anything to act on this, but I think for the most part, what I'm hoping for, cautiously hoping for, and I don't know with what optimism or not, I'm hoping that the unions will start going in a more sort of radical direction again, direct action direction again, as well as trying to actually engage their members. Because again, this isn't saying you don't pay dues at all. This is saying you don't have to pay dues. So what's the best way to get people to continue to pay their dues into these unions? It's to actually engage the members actively on a regular basis and not passively. Because if you're continuing to explain to members all the time or people covered who aren't members, this is what we're doing for you, and they agree with your strategy, they're going to pitch in for the dues. And so this may actually be a jolt that helps some of the unions, but I think for the most part it's going to be bad, at least in the short term. But, you know, if they're concerned about hemorrhaging a whole bunch in a lot of places, you know, start campaigning to keep them in and show why you deserve that. The problem, of course, is that the right-wing dark money machine is in full swing trying to individually campaign to members to say that they don't need to pay their dues and they shouldn't pay their dues and they shouldn't be members of the unions. And of course, as the Supreme Court decided in this case, for some reason, the other reason it's a First Amendment violation is because every individual public employee sector worker should be able to individually negotiate their own contract with their gigantic state and federal and county employee systems. Nate,
I just want to throw in something from this Atlantic article. Spark Janice, an employee of the Illinois Department of Healthcare and Family Services, argued that his union's attempts to negotiate on behalf of him did not take into account the fiscal crises in Illinois. He basically disagreed with the union's position in trying to negotiate for higher wages and benefits. So he's mad about the budget deficit or something.
Oh, the pensions in Illinois is probably what he was mad about, because that's something we've done a segment on this show before, is the completely artificial pension crisis and how there's this huge dark money push, including with like PBS, to run like documentaries about the pension crisis and how everyone's going to have to make cuts.
Yeah, apparently there's some estimates that decision in favor of Janice could reduce the union membership. This is particularly in Illinois. By 8.2% or 726,000 union members, which is pretty significant loss of revenue and therefore collective bargaining power or whatever. So salaries of public school teachers could drop by an average of 5.4%. Wages of state and local government officials could drop by 3.6%. So this could pretty significantly impact sort of overall.
Rachel, your comments?
I just wanted to point out, Wisconsin, starting in 2011, passed a series of laws that really hamstrung the labor movement. And as a result, only 8.3% of workers are in unions versus 13.3% in 2011. And also, median salaries for teachers in Wisconsin fell 12.6% or $10,843. Between 2012 and 2015. So this could have huge ramifications. But I did also want to point out there was a good example of a union re-engaging their members and really working on things that are of importance to individual members. The Union of Domestic Workers invites its members to to attend CPR work classes, attend food preparation classes for clients that have dietary needs. They really try to meet with their members on a regular basis and try to engage with them on issues that affect them. So things like bail reform and immigration reform, because a lot of the domestic worker population is poor, is heavily immigrant, and those are issues that affect them on a big scale. So I think there is a message of hope in this article that if the union works to really engage with their members, really lobby for them to create better working conditions, they might not see as much of a cut as maybe the Wisconsin teachers union.
Yeah, we have seen tons of protests, especially by teachers recently, including in some in states that are right to work, I believe. You mentioned Wisconsin, and I wanted to bring in something from the article about some analyses already argue that Hillary Clinton could have been elected president had union membership be higher, specifically when we're talking about Wisconsin and everything that happened there. And there's estimates that right-to-work laws decreased Democratic presidential vote share by 3.5%. And, of course, the Obama administration did not really pursue card check all that aggressively, sort of just in name only, and then let it die. So that's kind of the situation we're at right now, where this could actually have pretty significant impacts in the coming election, so you never know.
There was also a recent Supreme Court decision on a different topic, the cake baking thing, a quote-unquote narrow ruling, which means that it only applies to the specific litigants and isn't supposed to be a broad precedent, basically saying that this company could not, I guess, bake a cake for a gay couple if they didn't want to. I think the big problem with this is that although it was, you know, ostensibly this ruling that only was supposed to apply to them, I think most people in the general public and the people who would be most likely to be trying to deny services like that probably did not understand that and will go ahead as if they were authorized by the highest court in the land to be tools to people like that. Anyway, I guess there's probably going to be a lot more litigation on that front. And it remains to be seen how that will go forward. That wasn't a great decision either, but I think, again, mainly because of how people will interpret it and the sort of signal that it sends. Not great either for, the future of various sort of civil rights and public accommodations and services things.
Apparently, Anthony Kennedy thought that the litigant was not treated with neutral and respectful consideration, so... Yeah,
okay, whatever that means.
Has elements of a clear and hostile impermissity towards the sincere religious beliefs that motivated his objections.
Final thing, since we're mentioning Kennedy again, comments from either of you about Kennedy retiring as we wrap up our Supreme Court section of this week?
I think it's really interesting that Kennedy's son was part of Deutsche Bank, which would float Trump real estate loans when no other bank would. That really highlights the fact that the elite is a very small pool.
Yeah.
that scratch each other's backs on multiple levels. So it the timing is suspect to me.
Well, I saw people being on Twitter, you know, to try to be all smarter than everyone else, being like, well, how would this even work? What's the alleged conspiracy here? And it's like, I don't know, man. It's just like, who knows? Because Trump has such weird business practices, it's unclear on who has leverage over whom. But I mean, the bigger picture here is just that all these rich people know each other and collaborate on everything. And they're, you know, ensuring all these disastrous outcomes on the court. And they're going to secure that seat for someone who's going to make it even worse. Like, who knows?
I want to say Deutsche Bank is also one of the banks, the only banks that like still lends to Trump or whatever.
Yeah,
so
I think it is the only one, and Rachel was alluding to that. But
to
yeah.
Do with that, yeah,
I mean, at minimum, it means that they had close enough personal ties that they could probably, you know, work the refs on getting the outcome that they
yeah,
want.
Well, like, and then also there's like Kennedy's whole consideration of his legacy. Apparently, he's super concerned about that, and it's like your legacy is you just stepped down in the middle and handed Trump another Supreme Court
also
seat.
Who knows what his actual like jurisprudential legacy is, because he has swung so radically back and forth on like not like a left right thing, but just his like his actual like judicial philosophy has shifted a lot depending on who was the other members of the court, because he seems very persuadable, essentially. There's a, you know, like he used to have all these rulings in favor of like gay rights or ending juvenile death penalty and things like that. And he would like cite like all these things that normally a conservative judge wouldn't be citing, or even many American judges in general wouldn't, like the death penalty one. I think he was citing like international law and stuff like that. That would be unheard of. And then he kind of like shifted back toward just whatever Roberts wanted for the most part. So again, very unclear. And then, you know, the other thing is that Roberts figured out on a lot of these that if he let Kennedy write the majority opinion, he would write it the way that he wanted it to go. Like, is, you know, so who knows what his actual legacy is, even setting aside the terrible timing of this. We'll talk about it on a different episode, I guess, but like this has brought up a lot of court packing discussions and impeachment removal discussions, because at this point we're realizing that this court is being fraudulently filled by a very suspect administration, and in order to not have everything destroyed over the next 50 years, there's going to need to be some pretty serious rethinking of how Democrats and liberals and the left approach the court.
Yeah, but also that's not for McConnell said that the precedent that he tried to set before the election, if a seat was open up, doesn't apply for the midterms, because the midterms, but you know, if like say Ruth Bader Ginsburg resigns or dies or something right before the next election, they're just gonna ignore all that and just fill her seat anyway. So I mean, there's no consistency here. It's pure power politics, which is honestly what Republicans can do, and you have to have a little bit of respect for them, because Democrats are way too concerned about civility, which we had a big discussion about this week for no reason at all. So
all right, in our remaining time, let's move to talking about the nationwide protests against family separation, and also sort of the abolish ICE slogan picking up steam. Certainly we've covered it here on this show before, and been on the, you know, earlier-ish adopter side of things, although there have certainly been some people in the trenches for many, many years now working on this. I went to the protests in Boston yesterday, and that was just sort of a fascinating experience. There was like a ton of just normal liberal people, not like leftists or whatever. They were all enthusiastically, you know, going with the chants and the signs about abolishing ICE, or even, you know, open borders. What is it? Oh, no borders, no nations, end the deportations, which I was like, okay. You know, but the thing that I noticed was just there were so many parents there with kids, especially the age of kids that are being separated at the borders. And I think a lot of these folks, and people have been tweeting at me kind of confirming this from their own anecdotal experiences, it's like a lot of folks who maybe wouldn't have necessarily gotten out there and marched and been totally outraged or whatever, or maybe didn't think about the issue of abolishing ICE previously, like they're so shocked and horrified by the prospect of these family separations that are happening that they feel they have to get out there. And I think that's something that, you know, I'm not a parent, but it seems very clear that like a lot of these parents have been really radicalized suddenly on this issue because of this. I'm a little concerned about that, because I think that like if the administration had done this slightly differently, like they had not done family separations, you know, like they did almost the same policy but slightly different, and like, you know, or just sent people back right away as a family, like something like that, something that basically wasn't this specific approach with this order of operations on things, I think there's a lot of people who maybe would not have realized how bad of a problem this was.
Right. I think it was a little out of sight, out of mind of the Obama administration. And, you know, a lot of people are going, oh, this is not America. Well, of course, ignoring, you know, things like Operation Wetback during the 1950s or mass deportations under FDR. So, I mean, even going back as far as we want to go back to Spanish colonialism and everything, that's Mexican-American War, everything. So this is not new. But the fact that, I mean, there are people in the White House that are enjoying this. Even people in the White House are comparing Stephen Miller to the Waffen SS. So that kind of tells you where we're at right now.
I saw some pretty cool posters, though. Somebody had a sign that said, "Wish you were here," with a picture of The Hague, and like a bunch of liberals were like real into that. There were like on stage at this thing in Boston. So, in addition to some of the various speakers from different organizations, you also had like Senator Elizabeth Warren, Senator Ed Markey, Congressman Joe Kennedy. They're like up on stage at this is the first part, not at Boston Common, like at Government Center. There were like on stage, there were like communist flags, like Soviet flags, DSA flags, like huge open borders signs that weren't even like handwritten. They were like printed out and stuff. And like, I think that normally somebody like Joe Kennedy or maybe even Elizabeth Warren wouldn't be caught like standing in front of one of those signs in a photo, and they just didn't care. Like, and so I, you know, I'm not trying to get too like carried away here, but I think there's maybe an exciting opportunity where like people are a little bit more open to a liberal left sort of cooperation. And are less uncomfortable with the radicals on some of this stuff because they realize that they're correct. Rachel, any comments here?
I went to the Boise rally. It was kind of interesting because it was all activist speakers. We didn't really have any elected officials speak, which I think really highlights how it is a ground up movement. So I think that's helpful. And I'm part of the Boise DSA, and we made some signs with some of their nationally designed posters. So we had Abolish ICE and Open Borders in Spanish. And we actually made extras and passed them out. And I was expecting some pushback, but people were pretty excited to take our signs and walk around with them. So it's very encouraging. I also saw a lot of families with children, a pretty diverse group of people. So it was very encouraging, but I didn't really see the communist flags or the super lefty flags. So I think Boise still has a ways to go to radicalize leftwards.
Yeah. I think my sort of general take on the Abolish ICE sort of movement taking off finally is what's going to happen here is the only people that are going to continue to be adamantly opposed to this are people who do not vote for the Democrats and will not vote for the Democrats. Anybody that is a leftist, regardless of the Democratic Party, right? Anybody that's a leftist is going to be for this. Anybody that's a liberal or leftist who would consider voting for the Democratic Party, they're also going to be for this. This is going to be a mainstream position very soon. I'm not talking about elected officials here. I'm just talking about sort of the general public and everything. Anybody that's like, no way, I can't tolerate that. I'm not going to vote for the Democrats because of this. They were never going to vote for the Democrats. Like, yeah.
Yeah. And it seemed like just maybe last year or whatever, it was Sean McElwee filling up the Twitter word count limit with just Abolish ICE again and again or whatever. And that sort of has increased its meme potential or whatever. But you know, we saw Gillibrand, de Blasio, sort of say things similar, maybe not exactly, where they're like, oh, we need to reorganize or whatever, but they're clearly being pressured in that direction. Also, Kamala Harris had previously said, no, that we don't need to abolish ICE. There are too many criminals or something. And now she said something else. And then Bernie had an answer where he sort of like waffled on it or something, and people were mad at him about that. So, but it kind of seems like this is being asked more and more, and this is more of a sort of mainstream demand. And we saw the effect of that in the NY14 primary there.
All right. If you're listening to the radio version, we're out of time for this week in our half episode. ArsenalForDemocracy.com, iTunes, etc., anywhere where podcasts are. You can hear the rest of the episode. We're going to be talking a little bit about Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez and her election to Congress in New York City. So you can go listen to the rest of the episode, but we're cutting it off for the radio airplay here. All right, guys, let's talk about Ocasio in New York City. Very exciting win. There's, I guess, no general election opponent, right? So this is pretty much a done deal that she's elected to Congress.
I think there is an opponent, but he doesn't have a Twitter or anything. So it's like, is there really an opponent?
Yeah. 28-year-old Latina Bernie Sanders organizer elected to Congress over, 10-term or something like that? Or many-term Joe Crowley, who was, I guess, supposedly like in potential line to be the next Democratic House minority leader or speaker or whatever, but like I have no idea who he was, and I think his district mostly didn't know who he was either, so that strikes me as a little bit maybe overblown, but who knows. I'm not really an insider in the House caucus like that, but Nate, walk us through what happened here.
Yeah, well, in terms of Crowley, I do think he was liked, and just personally I have families in my members of my family that do know him, and you know, that's probably plays into why he was being considered for speaker. But it kind of seems like he had very little national profile. We've been comparing this race to other potential races, including one here in Massachusetts in the 7th district. For example, Mike Capuano is much better known. He's facing off against a younger progressive challenger, Anaya Pressley. And so it kind of seemed like we were sort of wondering a little, like, a couple weeks ago, like, oh, does she really have a chance? And then she just blew him out, basically. What was it, 15 points, something like that. And we were just talking earlier before we started recording about how it kind of seemed like his regular people just came out and voted for him, and because they just thought, okay, this is, you know, sort of what we do. This is a Democratic machine. And then a ton of people who were actually inspired came out to vote for her and ended up being a pretty significant shift there. So
yeah, I mean, she really went out there and targeted folks, intentionally targeted folks who, like, you know, they'll maybe vote in a presidential general election or something like that, but they're not voting in a midterm year congressional primary against the, you know, Queens and Bronx Democratic Party machines. But she got a lot of those people out, which I want to also, like, emphasize, because speaking as someone who's, you know, worked on a lot of different campaigns and done organizing and stuff, and, like, it's a very easy temptation to fall into, which a lot of people did. I've done it myself too, of, like, using those tools, those digital tools that identify, like, okay, these are the people who vote, this is the elections that they voted in. It's very easy to say, these are the only people who will vote, I'm only going to focus on those people because I can narrow it down using these digital tools. The tools were designed in the first place, especially under the Obama campaign, because that's where a lot of this originated. They were designed explicitly to get people to the polls who don't normally vote. These were people who were registered to vote, but they rarely, if ever, voted. And she went back to the drawing board and said, hey, that's what this tool is for. I'm going to use it for that. And identified a lot of people who could be mobilized to come out and vote if they had a candidate that represented them. And I mean that in all sorts of senses, both represented them racially, economically, and equally importantly to all of that, represented them on the issues and platform. She ran a much more left-wing platform. She's a Democratic Socialist member, DSA, New York City, and they worked really hard for her, etc.
So, she wore out her shoes multiple times, had that extremely viral ad, and her posters, which maybe we want to talk about a little bit, were, you know, way better than anything. I don't even remember what Crowley's signs looked like or anything. And he sent, I think he sent a surrogate, like a Latina surrogate, to debate her in one of the debates. He clearly thought that he had this in the bag and horrendously miscalculated.
Yeah, he just phoned it in almost the entire time. And I think he did one debate with her and it went so badly for him that that's when he started sending surrogates. Like, I think it was a former city council member or maybe a former state assembly member or something like that. You know, so just sort of bizarre, the whole thing. She's someone who had lived there for a number of years after coming back from college. She'd been an organizer already in the area.
Worked for Ted Kennedy.
Right. Yeah. And she was like a bartender in the area and stuff like that. You know, coming from a pretty modest background, right now that she's gotten elected, you have Republicans and Democratic establishment people all over the country uniting together to dump as much terrible, poorly, thinly researched opposition research on her to try to destroy her reputation in advance. I don't think that's going to go over very well. And it's probably not going to have that much effect.
She,
I mean,
didn't
she's
share
already
tips,
in, so.
Apparently. She grew up in too nice of a house, had too many bedrooms or whatever.
Just a bunch of propaganda. A lot of it was from the block. A lot of it was just straight up false too. Like the stuff that, you know,
she went to Brown,
out,
right? Actually, BU, it doesn't stand for Brown. It stands for Boston University.
Yeah. So yeah, shout out that Boston connection there. You know, as you were alluding to though, like people, you know, drawing comparisons to Ayanna Pressley's campaign against Mike Capuano in the Massachusetts 7th district, which covers some various areas of like downtown Boston, Jamaica Plain, Cambridge, Somerville, and some places north of Boston. Like Nate said, this is maybe not a one-to-one comparison. They did like appear in a lot of stuff with each other and like campaign for each other and that sort of thing. But like Capuano is a much better known figure. It is a majority minority district. I think it's the only one in Massachusetts, but he's been there for a long time. He does do actual stuff. He's well known. You know, I'm probably going to support Pressley because, to be honest, like, well, you know, back in 2009, when Capuano ran for U.S. Senate, which is another reason he's pretty well known, Nate and I wrote a really long endorsement of his Senate campaign, and it was even featured on the Capuano for Senate website. But unfortunately, Mike Capuano campaigned for my opponent when I was running for office in 2016. So not to be too salty about it, but like, you know, I like Ayanna Pressley. She's a climate champion, and she could do some really exciting things. But like, does she actually have a shot? I don't know. It's going to be a lot. It's a very different race. She is also an established machine of her own, as opposed to Ocasio, who was kind of forming this out of nothing pretty quickly. Presley is like a very well-known figure, and a lot of, like, she has some pretty credible establishment endorsements. She's gotten a lot of people to stay on the fence between them, because as Jonathan Cohn, our past co-host on the show, has often said, they're going to need Presley whether or not she wins, because she's a very important figure in Massachusetts politics already, and very influential. Rachel, your reactions to the Ocasio win as we wrap up our show here?
I wanted to point out one thing. You said she was educated at BU, and I think her narrative of being highly educated and then being underemployed as a waitress and a bartender is one that really resonates with millennials, who many of whom are suffering from the same plight. We are overeducated and underemployed and just want a fair shake at living a dignified life. And I think that is a very winning message.
It's also very exciting that she did run openly on a lot of different things, you know, abolish ICE, prison abolition, I think, was in there, you know, cash bail.
Then there were complaints that sort of thing. She didn't talk enough about cash bail. And it's like, she went to Rikers to talk about cash bail. What are you talking about?
No, they
about?
Just didn't. I mean, that's the thing, right? They're saying a lot of stuff now that's just flat out false. Like, it's, they didn't even
check. Or they
check,
try to bring,
like,
it down to, oh, it's the demographics of the district, without checking that actually all demographics voted for her at pretty consistent rates. It wasn't just like, oh, there's a Latina running. It's like, oh, there's a Latina that actually supports what we want, so everyone's going to go out and vote for her. But yeah, and then there was also, I mentioned before about her posters, which I thought were pretty cool, sort of going with like
in
a,
both languages, right?
Yeah,
in
both
English and Spanish.
English and Spanish. They sort of have like a speech bubble, like in conversation with each other. They have the, I don't know what the term is, the like on both sides of her name with the exclamation point, one facing upwards. So I just thought it was interesting and sort of a fresh look. Bill, of course, you're sort of going through that in terms of design and things like that. But
oh yeah, I guess we'll just mention as we're wrapping up here.
Yeah,
that,
let's throw that in there.
Yeah. Not officially. I mean, I'm in enough that it's like an announced thing, but like, there's going to be an open city council seat next year in Newton, Massachusetts, and I'll be running for that. Next year. I can't really talk that much about it on the show, although this is the non-radio part, so it's a good time to mention it. But yeah, so like, you know, folks can find my website through my social media accounts and everything and learn more about that. But I will be running for city council. So at some point, the show will be going on hiatus again, but because for legal reasons. But that apparently, I talked to the radio station, won't be happening for quite a while. So you can stay tuned for that.
He's doing electoralism.
Oh, yeah.
Doomed to failure.
So an interesting week of a combination of some really cool, interesting developments and some just truly terrible things that have happened. But like we said at the top of the show, like, we wanted to go over these things and kind of highlight them a bit, because some of them, like I think the Janus thing and the Muslim ban thing, are like already being swept aside in just the raging torrent of things that are happening this week. And we wanted to, you know, like, draw a little bit more attention to that. Anybody have any closing thoughts on anything that you feel like we had to go pretty fast through this, but Rachel, like, anything that you wanted to, like, underscore?
Just that we need more young people running for office, to kind of fight these establishment machines. The Democratic Party in Idaho is a shambles, and we definitely need some new blood and fresh faces running for office in Idaho. So this is a very encouraging, turn of events.
Uh-oh, Rachel, you know what that means. It means I'm going to recruit you to run.
I can't. It's a conflict of interest.
All right, Nate, your final thoughts on everything?
Yeah, I guess just similarly, that to the extent that this inspires people, and, you know, one congressperson alone is not going to, you know, make the entire difference. But if you could build up sort of because there is a congressional progressive caucus or whatever, and if you have a significant number of sort of younger millennial types that are going to be in there for a while, then you can start building a power base and then go on from there. Obviously, that's not going to, you know, solve every problem that exists in the world, or, you know, create a new system that some people want. But at the same time, it's probably better than having Jill Crowley in there still. So
I saw some pretty horrifying graphs about the average age of the Democratic leadership.
72. Yeah,
I was normal. Like, what is happening? So, all right, that's going to do it for us. Nate, thanks for being here in studio this week.
Thanks, Bill.
And Rachel, thanks for being on the line.
Thanks for having me, Bill.
That's all the time we have this week. Tweet us your comments at AFDRadio or email AFDRadio@gmail.com. The show is available for download from ArsenalForDemocracy.com on Tuesdays. You can hear it on the air in Delaware from 91.3 FM WVUD and WVUD HD1 Newark every Tuesday at noon Eastern. Our theme music was composed for us by Stuntbird. If there are articles or papers discussed in an episode, we usually post links to them on ArsenalForDemocracy.com along with each episode. From my studio in Newton, Massachusetts, I'm Bill Humphrey, and I approve this message.